Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
TikTok, TikTok, as Joe Biden's presidential life ebbs away, he signs an act of international piracy, seizing the most popular social media platform on the United States horizon, indeed anywhere in the world. He seizes it. He orders the company to sell or be banned. I'll be asking why later in the show. And TikTok, TikTok, as little Rishi Sunak's premiership life ebbs away, although a better life awaits for him in California with his green card and his billionaire wife. He ups Britain's war spending to 2.5% of our GDP, an extra £75 billion worth of expenditure on war and weapons. Well, we're rolling in money. Who needs it? And as the 700 dead bodies are dug from the mass graves outside Palestinian hospitals in Gaza, Britain's deputy prime minister, in front of my eyes just a few hours ago, describes these as allegations of misconduct, which we can trust Israel to fully investigate. It's all coming up over the next 2 hours because, hey, this is the mother of all talk show.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
TikTok, TikTok. Now, we're running a poll on it. Who do you trust least? TikTok, Meta, that is, of course, Facebook, or X, that is, of course, Elon Musk. It's rather a low poll at the minute. 19,000 people have voted, and I've only just mentioned it, but extraordinarily perspicacious, because it turns out in our poll of getting on for 20,000 people, the public trust TikTok the most of these three big platforms, social media giants. That'll be why TikTok is the one that's getting the boot, at least from the United States. Though what happens in the United States very frequently crosses the Atlantic with increased rapidity. So who knows who'll be next to ban TikTok? Well, I'm actually sitting in the British Parliament right now, and guess what? TikTok is banned in the British Parliament. I can get Twitter, I can get Meta, Facebook, Instagram, any of these things. In fact, there are things that I could get that I don't want to get, but which are sent to me anonymously by X, for example. I get nudes in bio, sex bots all day, every day here in the British Parliament, but I can't get TikTok. That's because China is now officially an enemy. I can't go into it too deeply because it's a live trial, but two members of staff in this very building, not my members of staff employed by leading conservative critics of mine who are never done telling me that I'm a traitor, those two members of staff of Conservative MPs have been arrested and charged with spying for China, which is described in the indictment as an enemy, about which more later. The truth is, TikTok is being banned not actually because it's Chinese. TikTok is being banned because the Israel lobby in the United States has placed on record that we have a TikTok problem. What they really mean is we have a young people's problem. Young people in overwhelming number all over the United States, including young Jewish people in unvanquishable and ever-growing numbers, are a problem for the Israel lobby because there's an uprising going on in the United States amongst young people against the crimes being committed by the apartheid genocidal state of Israel. It can be seen on the campuses of America's great universities and even now some of its less than great, at least less than famous universities. Yale has risen up. NYU has risen up. Columbia, above all, has risen up. And the more the authorities bring in the National Guard, anti-terrorist police, I'm not making that up, the more they try to describe the protests of the students in America's universities as hate fests, even nests of terrorism, the more the young people are standing up to them. It is a truly inspiring phenomenon, last seen in the United States in 1968, when an uprising on campuses all over America began over the American war, genocidal war against the people of Vietnam. In 1968, there was another senile Democratic president by the name of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who may very well have murdered his predecessor, Jack Kennedy, in Dallas, who became the president who intensified the Vietnam War to unprecedented levels. In 1968, that senile American crook, Lyndon Baines Johnson, ordered the National Guard onto the campus at Kent State University and gunned down more than 20 people, more than 20 students were shot down, many of them killed by the National Guard on the orders of a Democratic Party president because they were protesting against an unjust genocidal war. Well, they say history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. That's what Joe Biden is doing right now. And in the lead up to the Democratic Party's convention, this uprising will follow him all the way to the podium. And no doubt, his goons will club them down like they did the young people protesting the Vietnam War in Chicago in 1968. The whole world is watching, the crowd chanted as Mayor Richard Daley's thugs laid into them, fired gas at them, clubbed them down, even shot them. Well, the whole world is watching Joe genocide Biden as he does exactly the same thing in the uprising on campus. But the uprising on TikTok is, if anything, more significant because these are not students at Ivy League universities, brave but privileged and a small minority of America's population. On TikTok, millions upon millions are rising up to say, "Hey, Joe, where are you going with that ban in your hand? How dare you threaten to close down TikTok? We get a lot of our information from there," and therein lies the problem. There are 10 times as many videos on TikTok because there are 10 times as many people posting them in support of the beleaguered, besieged, and massacred people of Gaza than there are supporting the genocidal apartheid state of Israel. Well, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? How many supporters do you really think that Netanyahu has outside of Israel for these massacres? Well, not many on TikTok, that's for sure. And that's why Joe Biden today in the Oval Office committed an act of international piracy. He held a gun at the head of the American company that owns TikTok in America and said, "Sell. Sell to someone we approve of, or we're closing you down." That's the new American law. It's freedom, you see, the land of the fee. Sorry, free. It is democracy, don't you know, in America. And democracy in the United Kingdom isn't much better. Little Rishi Sunak was in Berlin today. Must have been quite a task for people to work out which was the more diminutive of the two rulers on view, little soldier Schultz or little Rishi Sunak, who's taken, by the way, I can confirm, having stood right next to him in the corridor in Westminster last week, taken to wearing elevator heels. I don't know if Schultz did. I don't know if they had a measuring contest of who had the biggest elevator heels. But the two of them were acting big. The two of them were strutting around planning a European army. The very thing that they said during the Brexit referendum was swivel-eyed lunacy to suggest that's what they were planning. They are now going to have a European army. And though Britain is not in the EU because its people decided to leave it, we're going to be in the EU's army. And moreover, we're going to lead that army, don't you know? It's like going back to Waterloo in 1815. Us and General Blücher are going to make sure that Johnny Frenchman doesn't establish a leading role in that European army. Us and the Germans are going to take the lead. In order to persuade us of the wisdom of that, the government sent little Grant Shapps. How many of these miniatures do the Tory government have in their cabinet room? Little Grant Shapps, as he's now known, he used to be known by a multiplicity of names when he was pretending to be various identities in his previous business career. He was sacked ignominiously from many minor positions in the Conservative government. But now, little Grant Shapps is our war leader. And what a war leader. He's going to spend not 2% of our GDP when France and many other, Italy, many other European countries don't spend anything like 2% of their GDP, their people demanding instead houses and hospitals, schools, better health for their people, more economic opportunity for their people. In Britain, we spend 2%. It's an ironclad consensus, you see, between Labour and the Conservatives. Let's spend as much as we can possibly get away with on weapons and war. Moreover, weapons which our own people in our own armed forces won't even see. It was made plain by little Grant Shapps today that most of the increase in expenditure, 75 billion extra per year, is going to the Ukraine. It's actually going to little Zelensky, another midget, is getting another huge tranche of the 75 billion pounds extra on top of the hundreds of billions we already spend, is going to Zelensky in a war which may well be lost by the summer holidays, judging by the pace of Russia's advances, the collapse of the Ukrainian lines. The lines of coke remain vibrant. The military lines are collapsing like a house of cards. So it may very well be that before Britain has managed to send the extra money, little Zelensky is sitting on the beach in Miami or in Tel Aviv or perhaps in both. The British government's bravado over spending even more money on weapons and war to send to Ukraine is only possible because the so-called opposition in Britain is in lockstep with little Rishi and little Grant. As the Tories pledged 2.5% of GDP on weapons and war, Labour cried out for more. Why only 2.5%? Are you really going to do it? Or is this just an announcement for show? Summed up the Labour response. Well, my take on it is this. If I went anywhere in Britain and pointed to a pothole, pointed to a derelict building, pointed to a shaky bridge, pointed to a decrepit motorway, if I went to any hospital and went into the A&E and saw the line for 12, 15 hours to be seen by a doctor, if I went to a school with crumbling infrastructure and not enough tech equipment, a field for football that resembles something that's been bombed by a warplane, and asked the parents there, should we spend this money here in this school, in this hospital, on these houses, on this motorway, on filling these potholes, or should we send it to Zelensky? I can assure you that 99% of the people would choose the former rather than the latter. But hey, that's democracy, shamocracy, where both parties, the only two possible governments, are in such lockstep that, like the animals in George Orwell's Animal Farm, you look from man to pig and pig to man and man to pig and back again, and you cannot tell the difference. And that is exactly true also in the United States of America. Let me close on the Al-Shifa and Nasser mass graves. I might as well, because not one single British broadcaster or British newspaper has covered in more than News in Brief, and usually not in News in Brief at all, the fact that 700 corpses, many with their hands tied behind their back, many still in scrubs, many still in bandages with their stitches visible on their wounded stomachs, have been found in mass graves. Now, for someone of my generation who remembers the sights and sounds of the Red Army's liberation of the Nazi death camps, the beast of Berlin's worst crimes, the sight of mass graves, emaciated children, the sight of lacerated, mutilated children, the sight of gaunt, starving, sick people being found in a mass grave arouses in me a passion which I can scarcely quench sufficiently not to swear into this camera right now. But somehow, the mass media in Britain is able to ignore it with absolute equanimity. They don't give a damn, won't even report it, never mind analyze it. And in the House of Commons today, the Labour leadership raised anything, everything but these mass graves, the ongoing genocide, massacre of the Palestinian civilian population, most of them women and children. They didn't even raise it. They didn't allow the word Gaza to cross their lips, and neither did a single Labour member of Parliament. It was left to a young woman, the deputy leader of the SNP, the Scottish National Party, to raise the existence of these mass graves and to compare the outrage over alleged mass graves in the Ukraine with the total silence over the mass graves in hospitals in Gaza. The deputy prime minister, because little Rishi was away standing on top of a tank to avoid looking like the prime minister he is, the deputy prime minister scolded the SNP deputy leader. How dare she compare the crimes of Russia with the crimes of a democracy in Israel? In Russia, he said, we have an authoritarian dictatorship. But a democratic country can commit genocide much more nicely, apparently. He said, we can be sure that democratic Israel will investigate any allegations of misconduct. That's how he describes dead bodies shot in the back of the head with their arms tied behind their back, still in their medical uniforms. These are allegations of misconduct. Moreover, we can be confident that democratic Israel will properly investigate them. Now, I'm going to say something very strong, which if I said downstairs in the chamber of the House of Commons, would have me removed from the building and banned for the rest of the day, if not for longer. The Deputy Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is a liar. He knows extremely well, must do. He's seen the Foreign Office legal advice that they're refusing to show the rest of us. Not only that, democratic Israel is committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes which plausibly, in the words of the ICJ, can be described as genocide. He knows that. But he calls them allegations of misconduct and misleads the House of Commons, though I'm glad to say not most of the public, that any allegations of misconduct by Israel will be investigated. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge here in London I could sell you going cheap. Right after this 60-second break, we've got the one and only Scott Ritter, the seer, the sage, the authority, the inspector. Don't go away.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, I told you about this poll. Who do you trust least, TikTok, Meta, or X, Twitter? You can vote on my Telegram channel, t.me/George Galloway. You can vote on my X, my Twitter account. You can vote on the YouTube community poll or on the YouTube stream. If you're watching the show on the YouTube stream, please share it. If you're watching on Facebook, please share. We've got to beat algorithm somehow. Mind you, we're now clocking over 3 million views for the mother of all talk shows every single week. And last week's interview with the one and only Scott Ritter became the biggest clip ever in the history of the Mother of All Talk Shows. It's currently closing in as a clip at more than 1 million views across the various platforms. That's because there's nothing that Scott Ritter doesn't know about military affairs, about military political affairs, and about the crossover, the Venn diagram involving both. There's nothing he doesn't know about the military-industrial complex because he was a part of all of these things. Scott Ritter was an intelligence officer in the US Marine Corps, and he was an arms inspector, not just famously in Iraq, but also in the territories of the former Soviet Union. He was someone who was an authority and a trusted authority within the United States on these military political affairs until he opposed the war on Iraq, until he told the truth about the non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Scott Ritter is a truth teller. He's a whistleblower. He's a man who uses his inside information and wisdom, sagacity, in the interests of peace, in the opposition to unjust wars that don't need to be fought and are not likely to lead to any good. I'm glad to say he's going to be joining us every Wednesday night. As long as this emergency lasts, Scott, but that might be a long time, mightn't it?
Well, unfortunately, yes. We don't see any pathway to peace. Logic dictates that there's many pathways to peace, but we seem to be in a world where illogic reigns supreme. Not just illogic. We live in a world where normal standards no longer apply. Moral compasses, the differences between right and wrong. You know, you and I are the same generation, and I listened to your outstanding monologue, and why I don't understand how people who have been put in a position of responsibility don't share your horror at what's happened. It doesn't matter where you stand on an issue politically. It matters where you stand on determining right versus wrong. There is no circumstance under which you can justify taking innocent civilians and medical staff out of a hospital, tie their hands behind their back, and execute them. There's no scenario whatsoever that can be painted as something that is justifiable. It must be condemned from the bottom of your heart, from the bottom of your soul. There's also no world in which we can justify continuing to fund a war that has already cost a nation we proclaim as our friend, Ukraine, a 500,000 lives. What friend allows a friend to be led down the road to slaughter? It's not a friend indeed. And I think we're seeing that the United Kingdom, the United States, and all of these European democracies that proclaim to be the epitome of, you know, moral certitude stand for nothing. We are actually the opposite of what we proclaim. We have become the living manifestation of evil on this earth. And I don't say that easily because I am an American. I'm a proud American. I love my country. I love what we claim to stand for. And I am deeply saddened to see the United States and our mentor, the United Kingdom, headed down the path they currently are.
Amen to all that. As a sidebar, if you like, whilst it's true that little Schultz and little Macron and the other European midgets are going along with all of this, there is no doubt that it's an Anglo-Saxon driven affair, is it? What is peculiar about us that we love war, unjust war? How did we get here? We were once allies of the Soviet Union to crush fascism. Now we're funding fascism. How did we get here, Scott?
Well, not to insult the British people. But I think we understand that during the Second World War, it was still the British Empire. And while Winston Churchill was absolutely heroic when he said he would fight them on the beaches and fight them in the towns and defeat the Nazi the enemy, at the end of the day, he was defending empire, the British Empire, which committed many, many sins in the name of empire. And after the United States sought to dismantle the British Empire and the French Empire and the Dutch Empire, we replaced it with an American empire. And that's where we are today. We're committing the sins of empire. The British, we flipped the roles. America used to be a colony of the United Kingdom of Great Britain. Today, the British people are, you know, you are a colony of the United States. You can't exist without us. You are nothing without us. You stand for nothing. You've allowed yourself to be so deeply subordinated to us that you are, in fact, one in the same, except you're not, because we don't view you as equals. To us, you're simply a colony that we will use and then dispose of, just like we're disposing of Ukraine, just like we'll dispose of everybody else. But this is about American empire. This is about sustaining American empire. And we treat the British like we treat the French, like we treat the Germans, like we treat everybody in Europe as subordinates who are there to do our bidding. We have basically put the French and the Germans in an untenable situation. They've been locked into bad policy. They have no other options, just like the British have no other options. I mean, they do. They could listen to you. But that's right now, that seems unlikely. You know, the way your government is has been created, the political and economic elites that back your government and my government, it's the same. It's all about money, the corruption of money, the corruption of power. We allow, you know, the lure of, you know, big homes, big cars, big bank accounts to cause us to turn a blind eye to what really matters, which is human beings, the human dignity, and an absolute necessity for us to run to the aid of humans who are suffering, but we're ignoring them. We've stifled their shouts. We've turned a blind eye to their to the horrific images that are coming out. I don't know, George. I'm as befuddled as you are on this one. It is deeply, deeply troubling and deeply disturbing.
Now let's start with Ukraine, if we may, Scott. You saw all the Ukrainian flags flying in the American Congress. The America Firsters put Ukraine first, and Israel first, and Taiwan first, and they robbed the American workers of their tax money and sent it to doomed wars and cheered about it and imagined that that would be a good look as they waved another country's flag on the floor of the United States Congress, waving goodbye to the best part of $100 billion extra dollars sent to these wars. How did you see it?
Well, I mean, just that. This is the people's house. The United States Congress is sacred to the American people. It's the home of the implementation of the Constitution of the United States, that document that defines who we are and what we are as a people. It sets forth the principles and values of a nation. And so one would hope that when the American people elect a representative to go to the people's house, to the United States Congress, that they would behave accordingly. The sight of an American congressional representative waving the flag of Ukraine. And the reason why I raise my voice here is, you know, it's one thing to say that we are allies. You know, I could imagine if, you know, the British royalty or a British senior politician visited the United States, that maybe as a sign of solidarity, we would wave the Union Jack and say, hey, welcome to America. But that this was a celebration of the subordination of everything America stands for a nation that represents none of the values that we aspire to. Ukraine is not a democracy. I hope everybody understands that. On May 20th, the incumbent president Zelensky, his term expires. There was no presidential election this year, although the Constitution of Ukraine mandates one. He claims he hides behind the specter of war. The last I checked, the United States held presidential elections during the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln defeated George McClellan. During the Second World War, Franklin Delano Roosevelt won an unprecedented fourth term. And I do believe that we were still in a state of war with Japan when Potsdam went down and Winston Churchill was sent home for losing an election. Elections take place in democracies, and we don't allow conflicts to stop it. In fact, if there's a war, that's all the more reason for there to be an election, because the people's voice must be heard, must be heard. But in Ukraine, the people's voice has been silenced, replaced instead by this hateful ideology that links itself to the most odious person, one of the most odious people in modern history, Stepan Bandera, the progeny of Adolf Hitler, a man whose organization murdered Jews, murdered Russians, murdered anybody they deemed to be lesser people. This is a white supremacist government that is engaged in horrific crimes against humanity as we speak. And they have been robbing the American public, robbing the European public blind in a war that has nothing to do. And this is the irony of it all. This conflict has never been about preserving Ukraine. This conflict has always been about sacrificing Ukraine. And that is the epitome of the sickness of the Ukrainian people, that they can't recognize this. They were never going to win this war. No one ever believed they were going to win this war. The sole purpose of this conflict was to bring harm to the Russian people, to the Russian nation, sacrificing Ukraine in the vain hope that Russia would be so wounded by this conflict that there would be domestic political unrest that could bring down the government of Vladimir Putin. That is a forlorn dream. It's not going to happen. Vladimir Putin is strong. He has just been reelected. Imagine that, reelected. We call Russia a dictatorship. They held a democratic election, and the results are in. Vladimir Putin has been certified as the democratically elected president of Russia, unlike Zelensky. No, the Ukrainian people are dying by the droves. Look, the foreign minister of Ukraine, Kuleba, said it best. I think he finally had a wake-up call. He said there's no amount of military aid that could be sent to Ukraine at this juncture to reverse the tide of battle on the battlefield. The Russian advance cannot be stopped.
There's some graphics today in the British press, Scott, which say that these graphics represent Russia's summer offensive. Are you expecting an offensive, or will it be this steady incremental attrition that they've been following now very successfully over the last period? You expecting a big sweep?
The big sweep is happening as we speak. I mean, the nature of war. I've spoken with senior Russian generals who have all said the same thing. For those who are expecting big arrow offenses out of the Second World War, that's not how war is fought nowadays. The weaponry, the lethality of conflict is not conducive to that kind of action. You'll suffer too many casualties. Even a losing army like the Ukrainians, when equipped with the proper weaponry, can be very deadly. I remind everybody that the most deadly month of the war in World War II for the United States Army in Europe wasn't D-Day, wasn't June. It wasn't the Battle of the Bulge in December. It was April 1945, the last full month of the war. More Americans died fighting a defeated German army because the German army was fighting for its life. Ukrainians are still a very deadly military force. The Russians know this. They're treating them with respect. I have yet to meet a Russian officer or a Russian soldier who has fought the Ukrainians who has anything bad to say about the Ukrainians as military professionals. They all say that these are extremely tough troops, extremely brave troops who fight to the last bullet. They don't yield. They don't retreat. They don't surrender in general. And so the Russians respect this. I do see the Russians increasing the pressure on the line, and I do see them being prepared to take advantage of gaps as they develop in the line. But right now, what the Russians are doing is what they're going to do, maybe on a bigger scale, but it's basically putting pressure along the entire line of contact, waiting for the Ukrainians to break.
Now, in the time left, let's turn, if we can, to the Middle East, to the wider Middle East, because I want to ask you about Iran. Now that the dust has settled, presumably, and that tit and tat have been traded, and it's unlikely at this stage, at least, that there'll be a direct all-out war between Israel and Iran. How do you see the new balance of power?
I see that strategic deterrence has shifted in favor of Iran. Prior to the Iranian attack, Israel assumed, rightfully so, based upon the events, that they held deterrence supremacy. What that means is that Israel could do pretty much anything it wanted to and not fear the consequences of their actions, that most nations, including Iran, were intimidated by the potential of an Israeli retaliation so as not to strike Israel directly. But the attack on the Iranian consul in Damascus was a bridge too far, so to speak, and the Iranians had to respond, and they did. And the way they responded was masterful, because they sent a signal to not just Israel, but the United States and the entire world, especially the part of the world that believes in an American ballistic missile defense shield as being a viable defense against modern ballistic missiles, that there is no safe place in the world today, that the Iranians proved that they can reach out and touch any place in Israel anytime they want to with sufficient force to destroy it. The fact that Iran didn't do that is testament to the wisdom of their strategy, which was to demonstrate potential, not reality. And the Israeli response was so weak as to be a joke, but that proves that the Israelis understood very well where they were. The Israelis did not strike back with anything meaningful. It was a token response, because the Israelis knew had they responded forcefully, they would have been swamped by Iranian missiles. Now we have the Iranians, I think, behaving responsibly. You have the supreme leader who just doesn't want to go in the business of publicly calling out the Israelis, publicly shaming them. He says, that's the past. We don't need to discuss this, because neither side wants this to turn into a broader war. It doesn't matter how many Iranian missiles can strike Israel. At the end of the day, a broader Middle East war would be a disaster for everybody involved, including Iran.
And lastly, Shifa, the bombardment has continued. Rafah, the bombardment has continued day and night from the air. But Israel has now moved tanks and bulldozers and have constructed tents for people that presumably will soon be fleeing from Rafah under savage bombardment. Are you expecting actually a ground invasion of Rafah, and what would that look like?
We just spoke about deterrence, and the key thing to deterrence is when you have effective deterrence, when the side that you're dealing with understands that an action they take will generate a reaction that far outweighs the benefit they get from the action. The United States, Egypt, Jordan, and other regional nations have told the Israelis that they will not tolerate an offensive in Rafah, that there will be consequences. But they don't have deterrent superiority over the Israelis. The Israelis are not afraid of them. The Israelis aren't intimidated by the potential response, because they don't believe these nations have what it takes to do what Iran did, strike Israel, hold Israel accountable. And until Israel is convinced that if they move on Rafah, that the consequences will be overwhelmingly disastrous for them, they're going to move on Rafah. And they're going to move on Rafah in the way that the Israeli military knows how to do, with absolute indifference to the suffering, death, pain of the Palestinian civilians involved. They will bomb them. They will kill them. They will snipe them. They will machine gun them. They will drive them out of wherever they are today into refugee camps, where they will starve them. They will allow them to be thirsty. They will deny them medical attention, because to the Israelis, they are human animals. The Palestinian people are human animals. The Israelis have said that from the very top to the very bottom. Amalek is not a theory. It is reality. The Israelis don't view the Palestinians as people, and they are treating them as less than sheep. At least a sheep has value. To the Israelis, these Palestinians, they have no value. Their life is nothing. We saw that. They tied the hands of children behind their backs before they shot them. These aren't humans, the Israelis. They've become something different. They've become as inhuman as the Nazis, who used to tie the hands of Jewish children behind their backs before they shot them.
Wow. Scott, thanks for doing this, and thank you in advance for coming back next Wednesday for the Ultimate War Reports. And sadly, more than one war needs reporting. Scott Ritter, the authority, the inspector. Follow him on all his social media portals. Listen to him. He knows what he's talking about. This is the mother of all talk shows.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, I first met our next guest in Gaza. Now he's in Britain. He's a journalist of note and commentator. Youssef Al-Hellou joins us now. Youssef, my condolences and the condolences of all of our viewers at the frankly unimaginable agony that people like you from Gaza with family still there must be enduring on an hourly basis as each new atrocity unfolds. Tell us something about how it feels.
Thank you very much, George, for having me. I always like to start by saying that I didn't ask to be Palestinian. I just got lucky. My family survived 200 days of a brutal genocide. People in Gaza, they say, how on earth that the world is allowing this digital genocide to go on for nearly 7 months? This is the first genocide that's being broadcasted by the victims, George, and people have been documenting the moment of their own death. Like the rest of the population, my family, they're still in the north. They experienced starvation. Things are a little bit better now. There is international pressure mounting Israel, especially after it killed 6 international aid workers in northern Gaza. You remember that, led to an international outcry. Of course, Gaza is my beloved city. I've been reporting on this genocide from a distance. I'm in touch with my family whenever there's a chance because there is a problem with the telecommunications. I lost my sister and nephews and nieces and scores of my cousins and relatives across the Gaza Strip. Of course, I met you, George, in Gaza. And Gaza is described as the capital of resistance. As a matter of fact, George, Israel hates the Palestinians of Gaza so much because we refuse to vanish. And as you put it very well, that we refuse to go to their museum. And 200 days, the world has been watching this madness, this genocide. And amid international apathy, amid international conspiracy of silence, it's ironic that the world is sending aid to Gaza. And at the same time, they are sending bombs to Israel to bomb the starved people in Gaza. Now, Israel actually, George, rules by terrorism. It has been terrorizing the Palestinians not only for the past 7 months, but for the past 75 years. Since its very inception, it was raised on committing massacres after massacres, violence, ethnic cleansing, and it has been using Gaza as a testing ground for its advanced weapons and also for the American and German weapons against defenseless civilian population. It has been using Gaza as a scapegoat to scare and terrorize its neighbors. And we know that Israel enjoys a culture of impunity, and this impunity emboldens Israel's crimes. So if the world is allowing Israel to carry on a genocide, then attacking an embassy in Syria or elsewhere is considered minimal. So this is the thing. Israel is allowed to set a dangerous precedent that it can do whatever it wants. It can unleash its military might, kill the children, snipers. They enjoy killing the children in Gaza as they are watching or playing a video game. attacking the hospitals, attacking the journalists, the paramedics. There is no red lines. Israel is a pariah rogue state above the international law. It has never been held accountable, and it has been raising Gaza to the ground. They said from the very beginning that they will seek revenge and reduce Gaza to rubble. And my city is being reduced to rubble. I was the last journalist, George, to cover and film the beauty of Gaza, its historical sites, touristic places, although it has been closed for tourism because Gaza is considered the world's largest open-air prison. But my preferred terminology, it's a concentration camp. And this concentration camp has been transformed into an extermination camp. People have nowhere to go. It's like a fishing barrel. Israel drops bombs and people flee here and there, internally displaced multiple times. They don't know where to go. The sea has been blockaded since 1967. Israel controls the sea, the land, the air. He controls what goes in, what goes out. The reconnaissance drones that fly over Gaza for the past 7 months means that people have hadn't any proper sleep for the past 7 months. Only they had one night sleep when Iran attacked Israel. That was the only night that people felt that somehow they have a little bit of relief. So as long as this genocide is ongoing, then we will see more Palestinians are being killed and maimed. And this is to do also with the hypocrisy and the double standard policy practiced by the international community. I would like to see my family, you know, be safe. They are split between northern Gaza and southern Gaza. And to leave Gaza is not an easy mission. People have to pay the Egyptians a bribe up to $7,000 per head in order to leave. And this is really annoying that the Palestinians are being extorted. You know, our suffering is being exploited by different forces in the region. It seems that we are being dehumanized, demonized, and Israel wants any justification to attack the Palestinians because they say that you Palestinians, you have celebrated what happened on the 7th of October, and no one is innocent, and your children are children of darkness, and they will become terrorists one day. Kill them all, nuke them. You know, the Israelis, they don't consider us as human beings, and they have been using us as a fuel for their election campaigns. So Netanyahu, he is prolonging this genocide in order to survive, in order to avoid being persecuted and go to jail. And he also lost allies, the U.S. administration, Biden himself. So it seems that Israel is sending a message to the world that it is against the international law. And it is also sending a message that the Zionist lobby is the one is ruling the White House. So we would like to see an end to this genocide. But for how long it's going to go on, we don't know. We pray that our families will be safe. And we pray that may Allah accept the martyrs, our families, and we would like to see Palestinians gain their freedom. It's not acceptable that in the 21st century, people are being starved to death. It's not acceptable that Israel, you know, justifies its attacks by saying that people are being used as human shields. There's so much to talk about, George. But I mean, if I would like to summarize what is ongoing in Gaza, it's a genocide like no other. And we Palestinians, we will not finish again. We will continue to be steadfast and resilient people, and we will continue to inspire the rest of the world. All what we are asking for is liberation and freedom to live in dignity and to be treated as human beings.
Now, you mentioned forces in the region, and you touched on the role of the Egyptian state and its officials in this agony. One place where there has been a great deal of support for the Palestinian people is in Lebanon, where the head of the Israeli military today said Hezbollah is close to being defeated. I've no idea what he means by that, or whether that could conceivably be accurate. Why did he say it, and is it true?
I think Israel will never feel safe as long as it is occupying Palestinian lands and Arab lands, and it is being supported by the U.S. administration. Israel has been trying to drag the feet of the Americans into a regional war by attacking Iran and its proxies in the region, Iraq, Yemen, and Hezbollah. They know that if they are to go into a war with Hezbollah, they will have to bear the consequences, because Hezbollah has been improving its capabilities. And of course, Hezbollah is stronger than the resistance in Gaza. You know, Israel is an arrogant state. They just want to give you the impression that they are able to crush any uprisings here and there. But if this is going to materialize, we don't know. We know that yesterday, a number of rockets and drones, they struck places in Akka, in Jaffa. And we've seen how the settlers, they run for cover to hide in bunkers. I don't think Israel is interested to widen its conflict. It is only sending messages here and there that it is targeting minimal targets, military targets to Hezbollah. And because they don't want to lose the chance of attacking Rafah in the south, that's why they are trying to have a balance. Palestinians, of course, they pin their hopes on the conscious people of the world, the freedom-loving of the world. And the Palestinians, as a matter of fact, they got relief when Iran intervened, because it was the first time ever the Palestinians saw these rockets land into occupied Palestine since the 1990s, since Saddam sent his rockets to Israel.
I was there, actually, on the roof of Miss Shawa's very small hotel in Gaza when the Iraqi Scuds were arriving in Tel Aviv. I saw them with my own eyes. The Houthis are the only Arab country, Yemen is the only Arab country that has applied the strictest form of economic sanctions against Israel by interdicting their trade routes. They've cost the Israeli economy very, very dearly, which is why we're all supposed to now hate the Yemenis. What's your attitude to that?
That's why the rest of the Arab world, especially those countries who normalized ties with Israel, are embarrassed to see Yemen, which has been under war for a long time, poor country, that they are rushing to help the Palestinians and to try to stage a war of attrition with Israel. The Palestinians, if you ask them, they lost hope and to get any support from the strong Arab countries in the region. Of course, they appreciate the role of Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon. They say, look, the Palestinian cause does not only concern the Palestinians. Al-Aqsa Mosque does not only belong to Palestinians. The Holy City of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, does not only belong to Palestinian Muslims. The whole Muslim world, the whole Arab Ummah must intervene and help the Palestinians, at least to boost the morale of the Palestinians. When you see some Arab countries, they block the Palestinians from entering their countries and charge Palestinians a huge sums amount of money in order to escape the genocide. This is a letdown. This is a big disappointment, to be honest.
Now, your family are there. If you were Ukrainian, there would be a special lane for your family, fast track at the airport. Your family would be here with you. What members of your family have you still got in Gaza, and why can't you get them out?
I still got my parents, my siblings, their families. You're talking about maybe 50 members. And I try my best to get them to safety, but it's not possible without having connections in the Egyptian side. And it's not possible to get them out without paying the required fees or bribes. The reason why that we are unable to get them is due to the bureaucracy on part of the British government. I'm a British citizen, and we have been lobbying the Home Office, the Foreign Office. We've sent many letters to the Parliament. We did a number of campaigns online. And we haven't got any positive response. It has been negative. They say that the Ukrainian family union scheme was one of scheme, and things are different. You cannot compare Palestine with Ukraine. Of course, there's hypocrisy. There's double standard policy British people, they had the chance to sponsor families from Ukraine. Approximately 300,000 Ukrainians were brought to the UK. It's a good thing. It's a noble thing to do because Britain portrays itself as a sanctuary place to welcome refugees. But when it comes to Palestinians, it's a different story. They say, can you prove that none of them affiliate to Hamas? They say that Israel has the right to defend itself. They don't want to bring Palestinians into the UK because they don't want to put the finger on the Israelis and say they are responsible for their misery. So we are dismayed. We feel that we are abandoned by our government in the UK here, since we are British citizens. We are approximately 300 British passport holders from Gaza. And if this scheme has to be approved by the UK government, our family members wouldn't exceed 5,000 members. Whereas every day, hundreds of people come to the UK illegally. So what I'm trying to say, we are trying to highlight the hypocrisy and the double standard policy. The UK must stop its supplying weapons to Israel. It must exercise its diplomacy in order to, put some sort of pressure on the Israelis and say, look, you cannot do this forever. And we hold Great Britain, full responsibility for our suffering since 1917, when Balfour promised a homeland for the Jews at the expense of the Palestinian people. So Britain must apologize for this historical injustice. They must provide compensation for millions of Palestinians who became refugees in 1948 and in 1967. And it must recognize the Palestinian state. And it must, allow us to bring our families. That's why, we feel that we are neglected. And unfortunately, because we are not white, this is happening to us.
Finally, you're well aware of how Palestine has won the heart of millions of British people. But not, alas, in the main political parties, the Conservatives and Labour, and even as of today, newly, the Liberal Democrats. How does it make you feel when, for example, the exchanges today that I referred to, where Marie Black of the SNP demanded some government action, or even just condemnation of mass graves, to see her disdainfully dismissed, and Israel, the source of all the suffering that you've just described, is called a democracy that is fit to investigate itself. How does that make you feel, the British political class?
I've listened to her speech, and it's good to see and hear some statements by some officials that call on the UK Prime Minister to really feel how the Palestinians feel. We feel the injustice that we have been suffering and going through for the past 7 decades. Unfortunately, when we see the UK Prime Minister pledges over, millions and billions of money to Ukraine a few days ago, whereas the Palestinians who are being starved to death, the treatment is obvious that we don't count in the eyes of the British elite. And that's why so many people, they are not going to vote for even Labour or Conservative. And a number of people, they are going to vote for independent figures, candidates. I might nominate myself, by the way, and I need your support, George, because people, they don't really trust the political elite anymore. When it comes to issues like Palestine, people have been let down. We see millions of British people talk to the streets of London and across the UK, and they have been demanding for ceasefire for 7 months. And the British government does not listen. Why? This is the question. Do they have agenda? When we see Suella Braverman, she continues until this moment to incite against these demonstrations in London, calling them hate marches, and accuse those who are taking part in these marches, including Jews, as anti-Semite. It seems that they split allegiances. Are they working for the Israeli government or are they working for the British government? This is the question. They must work for the interest of the British people and listen to their demands.
Yeah. We first met when I broke the siege on Gaza with a land convoy. Two of the people on that convoy, John Herson from Ireland and Dr. Yvonne Ridley from Britain, were on that convoy, and they've just taken to sea out of Turkey on the latest flotilla to try and sail aid into Gaza. The whole audience will wish them well and bon voyage. But we know what happened there to the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish ship that sailed to bring in aid to Gaza. It was boarded by Israeli paratroopers, and 10 people were shot dead on the deck of the ship. How do you think this latest flotilla is going to fare?
It's a very important mission to highlight the Israeli siege on post in Gaza. Even though if this flotilla does not reach Gaza, the message has reached Gaza, and the Israelis are already threatening to block this flotilla. I was there in Istanbul a few days ago, and I reported from inside one of those ships. I met many international activists, pro-Palestinian supporters, and hopefully they will set sail in the coming day or two. But we know there is a pressure mounting on the organizers to cancel it, a pressure mainly imposed by the Americans on Turkey. But the international activists, they are prepared, and they took a training how to act, how to respond in case the Israeli commando forces descended on the ship. And they are willing to take all the sacrifices. They say that what the Palestinians of Gaza have been subjected to for the past 7 months is nothing compared to what we are going to face. Probably because they are international, aid workers or white people, they might have some immunity. They might have some protection, I mean. But we know that the Israelis, they don't respect anybody. They killed international aid workers. They killed British
they're not all white, Yusuf. Nelson Mandela's grandson is among them.
Thanks for
your wisdom. I do hope you get your family out. And if there's anything we can do to help that, please let us know, Yusuf.
Thank you very much.
Palestinian political commentator and journalist. Quick break. I'll be right back. It's your calls all the way to the end.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Let me take what might be the last call from Andy in Stockport on little Ben Wallace. Another miniature of defense. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi, George. I'm just going to get straight to the point because I know I'm the last call, as you just said. So basically what I want to say is a little bit about Ben Wallace. He was in the Scots Guards. He went straight in as a captain because obviously his establishment, he went to Sandhurst. Now, he became defence secretary as the Russians invaded the Ukraine. And I actually saw him on the BBC rubbing his hands with glee over the prospect of a war with Russia. And he was talking to two young Scots Guards recruits about the Crimean War, which was years ago. And
A hundred and fifty years ago. Go on.
Well, our army has been depleted by the likes of him so much since then that I doubt that we would beat Russia in the conflict. But he seemed to be very confident about it. He was rubbing his hands with glee. He had pound signs for eyeballs. Every time he blinked, it sounded like cash registers. But Ben Wallace used to be the managing director of a weapons company called Quintiq. Now, this was actually an article I read in the Canary. And it was Low Key that they're quoting. Your friend Low Key is quoting Ben Wallace was overseas director of arms company Quintiq, which benefited handsomely from the occupation of Afghanistan. Now, in 2016, they were given a contract to arm the Afghan military. And that would have been, you know, Cuban cigars and £100 brandies in a gentleman's club that night, big bucks for them. And now all those weapons are in the hands of the Taliban, which we're led to believe at the time were the enemy. But they don't care because they've made a lot of money from all that. And now Ben Wallace, when Boris Johnson got kicked out of office, Ben Wallace has been touted as a possible replacement. Now, if you're a politician,
Prime Minister,
and you believe, if you believe in your party, you would surely want to take that role. But no, Ben Wallace stepped down from politics and disappeared. And I actually looked today, I Googled, what's Ben Wallace doing now? And I'm not the only person that's Googled it because the search engine, the sentence got finished before I finished typing it. So other people want to know, but nothing. There's nothing about it. Ben Wallace, when we withdrew from Afghanistan, which was absolute shambles, when we betrayed those people, he was crying on the BBC about it. But I didn't know he'd made all this money and he was the director of the company. And now he's vanished when he could have... Mm. He would have been a better PM than Liz Truss.
Well, I'll tell you what he's doing, Andy. Andy, a great call. And God bless Stockport. I'll be there at the weekend. I'm in Birmingham, not in Birmingham, but in the West Midlands tomorrow night, giving a speech to support the mayoral candidate, Yacoubi, who is by far and away the best mayor that the West Midlands could have. I'll be speaking on a platform with him tomorrow night. And then on Friday, of course, I'll be in Rochdale. But on Sunday morning, I will be in Stockport. So I have a great deal of affection for Greater Manchester. And it's a dream for me to be the Member of Parliament for Rochdale in the Greater Manchester area, not least because Manchester is the football capital of the entire world. I'll tell you what Ben Wallace is doing now, Andy. He's talking to me. I was talking to him this very day outside the voting lobby, and I was talking to him about the points I was making in my opening monologue, namely, that the British armed forces are small and plummeting smaller. And it doesn't matter how many billions of our people's money you're going to steal from us because of your ironclad consensus across the Labour and Tory front benches. You can do that, whichever one of you, whichever cheek of the same arse gets the gig. Whenever the general election comes, one thing is guaranteed. That is that the arms companies will get very, very serious money out of the pockets of the British working man and woman. But as somebody else pointed out in the House this afternoon, you can spend all the money on what they call these toy soldiers, little Grant Shapps, never heard a gun fired in his life. Not even on a grouse moor, because he doesn't have the class to ever be invited onto a grouse moor. He'd be there, the guy with the silver tray, serving the brandy for the grouse shooters. Little Grant Shapps, a little grubby shopkeeper. That's all he is. But he's now there at the dispatch box talking about putting kit into the field. He knows nothing about military affairs. I could strip an SLR in the dark with a blindfold and I could put it back together again. I can fire a mortar, have done many, many times. Little Grant wouldn't know one end of a mortar from another. But there he was, pirouetting like the little phony that he is, talking about kit. Well, as somebody pointed out, you can have all the kit in the world, but you don't have any soldiers to carry it. And the reason is that Tommy Atkins isn't interested in your wars. He doesn't regard Russia, China, Iran, still less all three of them at the same time, as worth his life. To paraphrase, Tommy Atkins doesn't think Grant Shapps' war Ben Wallace's war is worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier. These wars that these phonies, these little tin pot soldiers want to fight from the dispatch box and in the leader columns of the Daily Telegraph or the sandpit of Newsnight are not supported by the British people who won't sign up for them, who will not join their army. Because when all the money's been spent on the kit for the field, precious little of it will be paid in wages to Tommy Atkins. Still less will be paid for him and his wife and children's married quarters. And when he's invalided out, when he comes back damaged physically or mentally, the people that sent him off to war won't give a toss about him. He'll be found in Piccadilly Gardens in Manchester, where I have picked him up. I picked up Tommy Atkins in Piccadilly Gardens in Manchester, drug-addled, drink-addicted, unemployed, homeless, suffering from mental health problems. And did the likes of Grant Shapps or Ben Wallace give a toss about what happens to the soldiers when they're finished with them? Absolutely not. It's been marvelous for me. I hope it was for you. I apologize for overshooting the close of the show by 5 whole minutes. But I'll be back again, God willing, on Sunday with the mother of all talk shows. I hope you'll join me, and I hope you'll bring another viewer with you. The big stories and the big calls are best made here on the mother of all talk shows. Thanks for watching.